Hi, welcome to Cultural Fugazi, an optimistic take on the culture of the end times. I am your host, Justice, and I'm joined by my co-host, Chris.
Hello.
Welcome back to part two on our episode about masculinity. We recorded this previously, and I just cut it in half, so we're going to jump right back into the action. Enjoy.
All right, and we're back. Woo. All right. So, next on the docket, we have Creed.
Yeah, so now that we have done interesting, compelling, honored narrative about, you know, the expectations of who you are and what you could become, and then we've done the expectations set on you by your father, we are now moving on to another story about fathers.
Yeah. But an interesting one, because so far we have had, now admittedly in The Green Knight, you had a bit of the king acting as a father figure. And we don't really have any conversation about Gawain's father, what the story is there. It doesn't matter. The king is basically, that's Gawain's dad.
Right.
Here we have a very explicitly absent father. Absent in a way that is important to the formation of our primary character. And, I mean, as far as the plot is concerned, a lot of the story beats follow, have you seen a Rocky movie? Good news. Then you know the progression that we're going to take. So I think the things that are interesting about this movie are, what are the ways in which it deviates from a Rocky movie? And the first way that we are presented with from the very beginning of the story is that this is the son of Apollo Creed, and Apollo Creed was not there to be able to raise this son and to be able to provide an example. So the only example of Creed that we have, of Apollo Creed, that Adonis has, is just watching films of his bouts. That's it. That's the only connection that he has.
Yeah, the one of the meta things of watching this film that I found really funny was pulling up YouTube videos of fake fights, you know, things that aren't real. So he like looks up his dad's fights on YouTube, and
yes,
knowing that those aren't real is funny to me. To also be like, oh yeah, no, of course, like, hey, how would you watch boxing highlights of, you know, fights from that era? Hey, you'd pull it up on YouTube or whatever. And it's just very interesting whenever he does that to be like, oh, that's weird, right? Like, hey, this is a thing that does not exist. Or, you know, the Rocky statue in Philadelphia as Rocky canon is wild,
yeah,
right? To be like,
good.
Oh, it's there because he's actually famous and whatever. To be like, oh no, it's there because this is a scene from a movie and we put a thing here, right?
It's very good.
So, you know, the film kind of plays with your expectations of what it means for these things to be literally true, right? For these things to be real, for Rocky Balboa to be one of the world's greatest boxers and have a little Italian restaurant in Philadelphia. But also what it means for, you know, Donnie Creed to, you know, Donnie, yeah. He is referred to
Adonis
Creed. He's referred to multiple times, to start life as Adonis Johnson, you know, not taking his father's legacy, trying to be, you know, his own kid. He bounces from foster care to foster care, to group home to group home, ending up in juvie for fighting because he's an angry kid. He's an angry kid and he knows how to do one thing, and he knows how to fight.
Yes.
So that is his primary way to express emotions, is by hitting things. Which with that, I'd have to go back. The thing that I did not do when rewatching Creed is I have not gone back and rewatched the Rocky movies with Apollo. I've watched Rocky 1 recently.
Mm-hmm.
But the Rocky film where Creed dies, mm-hmm, that's not in the top of my mind to really take any of this stuff forward with it.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, while there might be interesting, you know, discussion to be had about that, and there might be interesting ways in which it ties in, I think the thing that's important here is that the absence of the actual human, and it is just so delightful that you have Apollo and Adonis named after mythological characters. And for Donnie, his father can only be a myth that he both clearly looks up to because he keeps watching these videos and he keeps fighting, but also he is very explicitly rejecting in so many ways.
Yeah. What we come away with is definitely a man who becomes two people. You know, whenever we see him after he kind of gets out of juvie, he gets picked up by Apollo Creed's wife. You know, he was a son out of wedlock. He was an affair, you know, a child out of an affair with a celebrity father figure who's now no longer in the picture. So he's never wanted to be a part of that life. He then gets adopted by, you know, Apollo Creed's wife, taken in and treated as a son, and grows into a mildly successful financial something or other.
Yeah, so I mean, the sense that we get is that, you know, his mother, Apollo Creed, did very well for himself, and so his wife is left in pretty good shape. So when Adonis does get taken in, he is given the opportunity to, like, leave the streets and to have access to a lifestyle that involves, you know, financial security, a really nice place to live. And, you know, clearly his mother figure has, she's got connections. The sense that you get when he's talking about his job, she knows things about his job before he has told her those things. She probably knows these people. These are probably friends of friends. There's a way in which he has access to a world that he never would have had if he had not been taken in. And so the tricky thing there is that that's not his world. And there's a way in which it's not his world because he's not a financial analyst. You know, he's still angry and he's a fighter. But it's also not his world because he doesn't want to do the Creed thing yet. He's not... He doesn't feel like he fits there. So he flies down to Mexico and does possibly illegal bouts. Who even knows? But he is continuing to fight because that is something that he can't get away from.
And it's also the only legacy that he's building for himself, right? So, you know, his mother potentially helped him get that job. He doesn't want to use his dad's name to start his boxing career. So the one thing that he's been able to do, that he's been able to build for, you know, his own identity, is the fact that he is an okay fighter who does want to go fight. So the one thing he does is he takes the money that he wins from fighting and he flies to Mexico and he fights. And then he uses that to fly back to Mexico and fight more because he doesn't want to use the name in the US. He's going by Johnson as his boxing name, and really trying to build his own identity, which eventually comes back to change his life later on. But with that, you know, he quits his job, says, I'm going to be a professional boxer. And where does he go to start his boxing career? Where does everyone go to start their boxing career? In a Rocky universe, they go to Philadelphia.
Of course.
Philadelphia is an okay city. You and I have had a good time there.
Yeah, I'm a fan. I will say it's really interesting, and I think this gets to some of the tension that this character feels throughout much of the movie. He doesn't want to trade on his father's name, but he does go to the gym that his father trained at, and that he knows that Rocky has trained people at. He goes to the place where the legacy, if his father were still around, probably would have brought him. So as much as he keeps pushing against his father's influence in his life and like that sort of like myth and legend, he does keep just like walking, right, like just gravity just keeps just pulling him in that direction.
We kind of get this interesting, what I think is an interesting push and pull from this character, right? So he wants to start his own legacy. He wants to live his own life. He also immediately loses a Mustang in a fight, right? Like he says, if you can take me down, you can have my car, because he's coming from a position of wealth that he also really isn't super attached to. To then move into a studio apartment mattress on the floor to start his boxing career. That being said, he is not what we've seen as our primary masculine character for a lot of these other things. He is, even when he's in juvie, he says, quote, I beat his ass because he said something about my mom. Right.
Yes.
Like he's coming from a different perspective, which is what the Northman had an issue with, which is, you know, love your mom, but like love your mom from a respectable distance. Skarsgård, come on. You know, like he's just a boy who loves his mom. He loves and his, you know, whenever he gets adopted, you know, he has affection for this woman who takes him in. You know, he feels guilt about quitting the job because he doesn't tell her, right? He doesn't tell her right away. So he obviously has opinions and thoughts about who this woman is and how she takes care of him and what that means for him as a person. He's not heartless about these things. He cares too much about these things, and that's part of why he's so mad. But it's definitely, it's an affection, right? Like he has, we are not dealing with someone who's emotionally stunted. This is a man who has emotions and doesn't know what to do with them. And the thing that he knows how to do is to punch people. And he's very good at punching people, apparently. But yeah, for him to then take on this journey where he could be entirely from zero, instead goes to Philly, goes to, you know, the roots of his father and one of his father's most historic fights, is either a reflection of him and his relationship with his father, or him and his relationship with the only living connection he has to his father, which is Rocky Balboa, who is working at a small little Italian restaurant.
Yeah, and I think that it's incredibly interesting because you do have in the previous movies that we have engaged with, particularly The Northman, you have people who are very much, they have a conception of what it is to be a man, and they are attempting to live up to that conception. I think in this movie, instead of having that, you have somebody who is influenced by the way that masculinity works in the world, but they are not attempting to live up to a specifically cultural ideal of what masculinity is. Like, I would even argue that, you know, it would be very easy for this movie to have been about, like, you know, black male masculinity and what that is and what that means, and to like shortcut some stuff or to fail to do the character justice by making it more about that than about this is Creed's relationship with his emotions, his father, his like all of these things. Instead of like leaning into that conception, he is very much somebody who he has emotions. He has like he is operating within the system of masculinity, but he is not necessarily being defined specifically by that or using that as a compass to try to figure out where to go. Instead of that, we have somebody who, you know, if in some cases is trying to push back against that. I think part of his I want to be self-made is a recognition that, no, I don't want this to be a hierarchy where because my dad was the best, I get to be the best. It is important to me to put in the time, to put in the effort, and to put in the commitment. And those things are something that I value, not because that's what a man does, but because those are things that I legitimately feel like this character values.
Yeah, he definitely is not what I would call at any point in time really a stereotypical interpretation of some of these traits, which is great because, as you said, kid coming out of juvie without a dad could be we could be dealing with a lot of stereotypes, but we actually get a man with a full range of emotions, and which is really compelling as we are then introduced back to Rocky Balboa, and the way that he approaches Rocky Balboa is with affection, right? This is the man who is partially responsible for his father's death. and some interpretations of how that movie works. And instead of that, he first sees a tool, right? I want you to train me. I want you to help me learn how to fight and fight well. But also, he refers to him as Unk, right? He calls him Uncle.
Yeah, they very much become family. And there's very clearly an emotional connection, although... And this is, again, a very fascinating way in which this movie operates in a much different way than the other movies that we've talked about so far. In those movies, you have had a patriarchal figure who has been the one who has set the tone or set the direction. In this case, you have some of that, but then that gets inverted. You have a scenario where the trainer, the father, who is teaching this young upstart kid how to fight, suddenly, hey, this upstart kid who is still not necessarily great at understanding what to do with his emotions, he is smart enough to know he's got to do something with them. And he doesn't let Rocky get away with becoming the stoic, lonely old man, of falling into the masculinity trap of, I can't be vulnerable, I have to push people away, I can't hurt them, I can't let them hurt me. Suddenly, Donnie is teaching Rocky how to feel things.
Yeah, the what I came away from the Rocky gets sick storyline is, if you've seen the Rocky movies also, Rocky Balboa is a moron. He is a dumb idiot who has been punched in the head a lot and has no idea how to interact with anybody. That's very clear in Rocky One. It's clear in every other Rocky movie. And when he is diagnosed with cancer in Creed, his immediate reaction to that is what we would call very masculine. I'm going to suffer in silence. I'm not going to tell anybody. The only person who matters is the people that I'm protecting and the people that I'm doing this for. And, you know, the thing that he's doing is he's building a newfound family, right? His family has moved on from him. His son is not around. You don't know if they have a relationship or not. It's not really critical to this story, but whenever Adonis moves in with Rocky to do the training, they really become a very clear family. We see that build. And then whenever Rocky gets sick and he tries to hide it from his family, you know, from Adonis, he's like, you know, what is this? You know, just do the treatment. Stop being such a weird, you know, toxic man about this whole thing. Be vulnerable. It's okay to be scared about this, but, you know, think about everything that you're going to leave behind. Think about me, this thing that you now have affection towards, and you're going to leave me behind because you don't want to do treatment?
Yeah, because Rocky immediately, after he hides it and attempts to be the martyr who, well, just no one can know, once Donnie finds out, then his immediate reaction is push him away. Like, you're not actually that important to me. What do you think? We're friends? We're not friends. I'm just training you. I'm not close to anybody. I've seen how this plays out and it's not good. So just back off.
Yeah. And not only that, but you can also see Rocky being like, Rocky's not good at it either.
Yes.
Right? He's still a man who's been punched in the head a lot.
Yes.
Where he's like, oh, why did I say that? You know, and I think it's a really, that relationship turns really healthy.
Yes.
It is a really great portrayal, portrayal, not betrayal. I'm saying a P, not a B. A really great portrayal of two men having a real family connection. You know, they really care about each other's well-being and their health. They want the two of them to be the best that they can be. Adonis is not going to fix Rocky's family issues or the fact that his son is not around, but he can be there for him when he needs someone to be there for him.
And yeah, they are supportive and vulnerable with each other in a way that, you know, at the beginning of the movie, I think arguably both of them are not great at, but interestingly enough, I think Adonis is better at it than Rocky is. And got to give a shout out to Bianca here. She helps. She's definitely very good at being like, hey, you're both being real dumb. Maybe let them in. You care about each other. Could you just please talk, please?
Yeah, we In none of these movies does anyone actually go to therapy. Again, but we do get close to therapy-like interventions from Bianca, who's like, maybe the Northmen had it right, the magic of women, right? As the way we usually portray them in, or, you know, show them in films, right?
Well, so I think that, like, this is a very interesting situation where I think that this actually takes that the magic of women situation and goes, no, come on, the Northmen, you got it slightly wrong. The relationship that Donnie and Bianca have together is a mutually supportive relationship, and it allows Adonis to like figure some stuff out, and he has the safety to learn how to be emotionally vulnerable in a way that then lets him help Rocky. But it's not because like he is doing nothing there. He is also being, I really appreciate how the movie, and this goes back to masculinity, this is not just about men take from women. They have the secrets, and you need to learn to let them show you this. It is, you should be a partner. And being a partner will allow you to lean on your partner and allow them to lean on you. Because we do see her get to lean on him in ways that makes it clear that this is not like a one-sided relationship. And that part of Adonis understanding why it's healthy for him to be a better person with Rocky and to be vulnerable is because he is vulnerable with Bianca and she is vulnerable with him.
What I found with that relationship that really worked for me was Rocky's found family journey, and she's immediately brought into the fold, no questions asked. And when they eventually get to, you know, Adonis living with Rocky, and Rocky and Bianca have a relationship.
Yes.
Right? Like they are two people, and they understand that they are both Adonis's support system, such that whenever he flies all the way to one of the other sides of planet Earth to have a fight, you know, Rocky is either Bianca or Rocky are contacting each other, and they set up, you know, her showing up, because, you know, you can have a family that has these types of connections, and it's, you know, healthy and reasonable, and to set meaningful conversations with multiple people in everyone else's life. Like you only become better whenever this happens, not worse. And I think they really build that stuff up, and it's really, really, it's funny too, when they do it really well. Things like, Adonis saying, "Oh, this is my uncle." And she kind of looks at Donnie, you know, looks at Adonis for a second, like, "Oh,
you didn't tell me your uncle's white."
Yeah, you didn't tell me your uncle's white, right? Like, and he goes, "Oh, no, not my actual uncle." But, you know, that idea of found family is one of the things that some of these other movies really don't touch on too much. Maybe our last one does a little bit.
Yeah, it there is definitely that aspect to it. But yeah, this is the one that hammers that point home the most.
Yeah, specifically what it means for, you know, two grown-ass men to have emotions with each other that are meaningful, right? They are both vulnerable with each other. It is a father-son relationship, but it's a very, very healthy one. They are more, you know, they're not, Rocky's not on a pedestal.
Yeah, it's not a hierarchy. Yeah. It is very much they are in an even playing field, and it is recognized that, hey, Donnie also has some things to give you, and you need to lean on him sometime just as much as he clearly needs that from you, Rocky.
Yeah. They're both two dumb idiot men who one happens to have more emotional tools in the tool chest. Adonis was raised eventually by caring, compassionate people. Rocky had caring, compassionate people in his life at one point in time, but now they're all gone. And it's really the way they play off of, you know, what it means to have affection. And also, at no point in time are these not the most freaking bro-ass broman that you've ever seen. You know, in this film, Sylvester Stallone is still massive.
Yeah.
Michael B. Jordan is a built man. And then, you know, they're shadow boxing while nurses are coming in during Rocky's chemotherapy, right? Like, these are I would say really, really, really healthy portrayals of what it means to be, we set up idealized relationships and idealized men. This is a very healthy thing. It's not the end goal, but it is definitely a state of living that you could look at and say, this is good. This is, these two men are going to get a better relationship and be better people because of the relationship they have with each other.
Yes, absolutely. There's mutual support there. And I think one of the things that is very important about this movie, and I think, so the last two movies that we talked about, I think are very much presenting a depiction of how masculinity works and have a commentary about that. But I don't think they're necessarily showing us, here's what it looks like if you maybe do a healthy version of that. They're kind of just sort of pointing out the problems and maybe pointing out some ways in which like those problems could like have interesting aspects or interesting solutions. But we don't get to see somebody who embodies some of the solutions that they, the green light, we're left at the point where maybe he could have done an Adonis-like thing. Maybe he could have been emotionally vulnerable. And in this movie, we get to see that. We get to see what happens when, and we do get to see some parts of him failing at that. And I think that's also important. You know, I think one of the things that this movie wants to make clear is that having these feelings and figuring out how to share these feelings is difficult for men. It is not an easy thing to do. And sometimes, often, they are going to screw it up. And if you're lucky, you figure it out. If you're extra lucky, you have a Bianca who can call you an idiot and help to point you in the right direction. But I think this movie wants to give space for the recognition that it can be difficult to be emotional as a man. It can be difficult to have emotions as a man. But look at what happens when you have the space to do that. And look at what a huge difference that can make in your life and the lives of people that you care about.
One of the things that the movie does that I found helpful for our guiding path of what it is to have manliness, what it is to have masculinity, is even our villains in this film. We don't have an Ivan Drago who eventually is a monster, but we build the monster, right? Instead, we have other people who are just really good at this. And not only that, other people who have to live this way. One of the things that Adonis has to deal with the entire film is he doesn't have to live this fighter's life, is what they tell him. He doesn't have to be a boxer. He's good at other stuff. He's college educated. He's, you know, has a support system around him where some of these people don't have this as an option. And multiple times the people that he fights, don't have anything outside of this life. Our big bad is a guy who's going to jail for gun charges in the UK. And he wants to be the best there is too. And his fight is cut short because he's too aggressive and he punches the guy and he's going to be sued for millions. And his trainer is looking out for him by scheduling this fight with Adonis. You know, he's like, well, I don't want to fight this young upstart who's nobody. You know, he doesn't deserve to be in the ring with me. And his trainer goes, I don't give a shit about you. I want your kids to have a house. You know, I want, you know, this is a hard life to live. And I want to make sure that you have set up your own success in such a way that the people around you who have shown you love and support are going to have something at the end of the day, kind of because you're an idiot, right? You could have had a longer career if you weren't so stupid, is kind of the takeaway from that. If you weren't such a dumb man carrying guns around when you shouldn't, right? That relationship is what drives our big bad, right? He's not this, he's an idiot. He's an aggressive idiot, but he does have a good support. He has people looking out for him, right? Like this whole thing is set up actually as an act of care. And whenever Adonis eventually loses the fight, he shows respect, right? And he shows that what's there, you know, like the relationship that Adonis, it's kind of the whole big, everything you've said is valid, right? Like the big rubber stamp of your emotions are valid.
Yes.
You know, his relationship with Rocky and all this stuff allows him to be a better fighter. And, you know, this ultra masculine, I'm going to jail, I'm tougher person, even comes back and shows respect. And, you know, I think that's really, as we talk about the other ways that we deal with masculinity in this film, that's that relationship between him and his trainer. And I forget the name of the big bad's name, but they're also treated like real people. Like, he's like the second best pound for pound boxer. And like, they do like these weird ESPN like cutaways and stuff, or like the HBO Fight Night cutaways. But they're treated as real people, and they're given space to have a relationship that's also kind of healthy.
Well, yeah, and a very important part of that is, and I think the movie is very interested in this, which I think Coogler is very, very good at having these conversations about masculinity. He wants to make sure that we know that this person too has emotions and has an interior life and has motivations for the things that they're doing. This is not just, I am mad, so I'm going to hit you. This is a person with a complicated life. And like, because of the ways in which this person might not have been allowed to express their emotions, they're going to jail now. But like, those emotions are there, and this person needs space to reckon with them too. And so the movie doesn't just want to cast that person through the lens of an antagonist who is evil or bad or not somebody that's like,
if he dies, he dies.
Yeah, exactly. The movie wants to make sure that you know that this is a human, that these are two humans that are in this ring.
Yeah, for sure. Outside of our big bad and his trainer and Adonis and Rocky, I don't think there's a lot of other like real. No. We deal with a lot of history. We deal with legacy, right?
There's some sort of like ways in which the movie points out the ways that hierarchy can work amongst men that don't necessarily like call out. Although we do have this is the best in the world versus this upstart, and how does that hierarchy work? But you get like the cards that the little cards that show up when a fighter is first shown on screen towards the beginning of the movie of here's so-and-so, this is their age, this is their ranking in the world. So a way in which you can see, oh, this is a very like stereotypically masculine way to view this. This person is number three. They are this difficult to fight.
Yeah. We're definitely introduced to a final boss.
Right? Yes.
Like our big bad is the big bad. He is the final boss. We do have a Giga Chad, if you will. I think coming back to it, to wrap it up, everyone seems like, even if they haven't gone to therapy, that boy oh boy have they made internal improvements, right? Almost unrealistically so, with who they are and their emotional growth. I would expect at least a psychiatrist or two, because everyone seems like super happy. Like, everyone eventually at the end of that film, everyone I would say is in a healthy spot emotionally, which Gawain gets there and the Green Knight. Gawain is eventually what I would consider somewhat healthy. He may have to die for that. Who knows?
Yeah.
And the Northmen, absolutely not.
Not even close.
No one is in a good relationship. At the end of Creed, I would say that we have some pretty solid foundations for everyone to be emotionally available and emotionally sound.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting things is I do think that Coogler does make some indications of the ways in which, you know, there are some unrealistic expectations for men, but what the film does a beautiful job of doing is you have these characters who subvert a lot of those and do get to a space where, yeah, they're actually kind of healthy. Good work, team. You did it.
And I think the takeaway is there are obviously at least two more movies.
Yes.
The third one is coming out at the time of this recording here soon-ish. We've seen trailers for it. I'm pumped. Creed 2 is a different film. Creed 3 does not have Sylvester Stallone in it, so some of that relationship either has to change or adapt, or, mm-hmm. or they're going to do something with that. Because they're tired of paying him money, and I would also be tired of paying him money. I'm sure he's very expensive. I'm really curious on how they'll continue to develop these characters. Whenever I walked away from this, I know obviously Act 2 is going to be a little bit of, but what if they're not as healthy as you think they are? And Act 3 looks to be, you know, the third movie looks to be, what if his time in juvie was more impactful to the rest of his life and the trajectory that he's taken it? Where his, you know, friend played by Lovecraft Country and now Marvel famous...
Jonathan Majors.
Jonathan Majors, yes. Thank you, Chris. Is in that and also looks like he's built like a brick shit house. My God.
I mean, did you see Lovecraft Country, though?
Oh, like, I know.
That's kind of the space that he inhabits.
Yeah, that's... I just... and you know what? Michael B. Jordan is, whenever he was in Black Panther, like, I was like, that's a big man.
It's not small.
Yeah. And then like, hey, what if, oh, I'm so excited. Like I'm super pumped for this.
Yeah. And I do think that there is a space where the third movie is a bit about, hey, Adonis, you've had a chance to get in this healthy situation where you have support structures and you've been allowed to thrive. What would it look like if you didn't? What, and how do you cope with the knowledge that, like, you got to do this, but maybe somebody who maybe was close to you didn't? And what does that look like? But we will have to wait to see what that movie has in store for us. I think even outside of this, this movie alone does a lot of really good work in sort of tackling these themes of masculinity, the ways in which it does work and the way in which it can work, and giving us our first lengthy, healthy depiction of this is a way that you could even be not terribly healthy and figure it out.
They have the right tools in the tool chest, right? They build a support structure, which you don't have to be perfect.
Yeah, you're not always going to be not angry. Matter of fact, it's healthy to be angry and to have ways to deal with that anger.
That usually don't involve getting punched in the head. Yeah, but usually. That's different. You know, people die in the ring, as they make sure that you know. But that's the end of Creed. We are moving on to our fourth and final film. And then we'll do a wrap up shortly thereafter. So stay tuned for Mad Max Fury Road. And we're back for our fourth and final film, Mad Max Fury Road.
Yes, indeed. And you know, with Creed, we looked at somebody who we got to see struggle through, maybe having a slightly unhealthy relationship with their anger and some difficulties sort of integrating their father's past and finally getting there. This time, I would argue that we actually, weirdly enough, start with a surprisingly healthy male?
I don't know if I would say that he is healthy. He's dealing with some unresolved trauma.
Yes.
So Mad Max, our primary protagonist, our main character, well, that's debatable.
Yeah. We'll get into that.
Our named character for the film, played by Tom Hardy, is picking up where Mel Gibson left off in the Mad Max trilogy with our weird apocalypse leather jacket wearing massive car driving man's man, right? He's a survivalist, he's the lone wanderer through the wasteland and is dealing with his current trauma. We're not dealing with his past trauma. If you know the Mad Max trilogy leading up into Fury Road, Max has done a lot of stuff. He's dealt with a lot of things. His wife and child were killed in the first movie, and then he meets a bunch of children in the second movie, and then the third movie is Thunderdome, and now he's here. Played by Tom Hardy, many, many, many years later. He's hallucinating whenever we first see him. So yeah. Healthy is strong. Healthy is a strong term.
I will say maybe healthy from the get-go is not exactly the right way to put it, but I do think one of the interesting things that we see, I don't think we see a lot of him needing to, we don't see a lot of him making very unhealthy, damaging decisions that prevent him from being able to get close to people. He clearly has trust issues. He clearly has a lot going on. He is seeing the image of his dead daughter all over the place. So yeah, that's not ideal. But, you know, where we have Donnie who is, you know, punching musicians at his girlfriend's show because they called him his dad's name.
And, well, really, because Rocky was diagnosed with cancer and he didn't know how to deal with his own internal grief.
Yes. And I think you could make an argument that, you know, Max doesn't have quite as many opportunities to make those bad decisions. But I think it's interesting that we don't really have a lot of scenes where he is making poor decisions that are born out of his inability to cope with the things that have happened to him.
Yeah, he's dealing with internal trauma.
Yes.
And he's not dealing with emotional unavailability, right? Like he's whenever he's open and there, like he's open and there for multiple characters. He starts as flawed and failed. And he doesn't really grow past that, but he doesn't really necessarily have to. His specific challenges through this film are he is captured by a group of hyper furious war boys.
Heavily inspired by, wouldn't you know it, Norse mythology.
Huh, weird. You know, if you were ever looking for allegory, they are in fact spray painted white.
Yes, they are.
Airbrushed white, if you will, led by a man who is a decorated war veteran with a circuit board and all kinds of various fake medals in a Morton Joe.
Yes, a Morton Joe.
And he has a bunch of half-life war boys. They're all cancerous or they're all dying, you know. Whether they're all his children or not is interesting. But all these children who are male children, primarily, I think nearly exclusively.
Yes.
As far as we see. Mad Max is captured by them. They take his car. Whenever we talk about things that are typically viewed as masculine, men caring about cars, super that.
Yes.
Chris, how do you feel about your car?
I mean, I'm happy that it exists.
It's new. It's new.
That's about the extent of my emotions towards my car.
I've driven the same car since 2012. I love it. If it was gone tomorrow, I would not give a shit.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yes.
Someone was like, hey, your car's gone. And I'd be like, oh, man. I guess I better buy another car. if someone stole my bike, I think I'd be.
Now that would be a difference. Yeah, that would be a much different.
I've spent time there. Like I get men in cars, but like we're both. Well, at one point in time, we're if not are serious cyclists. Serious is in quotes. So like if someone stole my bike, I'd be like, oh man, that sucks. But like, I would not John Wick them.
Sure.
I would not John Wick to them.
Sure.
Someone stole my car. So his car is stolen and used for parts. He's stolen and used for parts because, again, this is a George Miller film. We talked earlier that The Green Knight was like, oh, so it'll use for car. No. Everything is going to be exactly what it is forever.
Yes.
In this entire film.
Absolutely. I mean, though, it is very clear that the patriarchal rule of Immortan Joe is literally killing the war boys young. They are dying because of the way that his patriarchy operates. Like, explicitly. That is not subtext. That is very much text.
what is canon that we know from the last films in the Mad Max series and this films is that the main character's name is Max. That's about it. Morton Joe, actually played by the same actor who played Toe Cutter, the primary villain in the first Mad Max film, who dies. So, you know, who cares? Casting is like the meta commentary of films. Again, we talked about it with the Northmen, but the meta casting here is on point and very critical. This is also his last appearance before he passed in film. So, so we have a king who rules his radiated Viking war boys, and their thing is they want to drive cars into battle, led by their imperators, and their
ideally die a glorious death and be witnessed.
And be witnessed, in fact, with getting high on some spray paint, which, I mean, to each their own.
Sure.
Their imperator, one of the imperators, I don't know how many there are. We're not really alluded.
We know that in the movie, based on the credits, there are at least three other imperators, though I think only one other imperator is named.
Yeah. And we get Furiosa. She's about to drive this truck. They're going to pick up stuff. If you haven't seen this movie, like, I can't help you here. Because I'm not going to describe this one the way we've done the other ones.
Yeah, there's a lot that happens. And I think part of what would make it difficult to describe this movie is a lot happens. I don't know that all of it is necessarily key to understanding the way that the movie is interacting with masculinity. It's all very interesting, and a lot of it is very cool, and it is a beautiful movie. So I think the bottom line here is, if you haven't watched the movie, you should go watch the movie.
Yeah, I would say of the four movies that we talked about for this specific podcast, essay thing, the thing that we've done, go watch this one. If you haven't seen one, go watch this one. If you have seen this one, go watch it again. If you have seen this one twice, go watch it a third time. I think sure. This is for this watching or this conversation that we're having. I think this is the fifth time I have watched Fury Road.
I think it's close to that for me. Maybe even one or two more.
Prime viewing opportunities are as big and loud as possible. So if you see it back in a theater, which we're getting semi-close to, we're over the five-year anniversary.
Yeah, that would be delightful. And yes, if you have the opportunity, this would be a good one for that.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, so because it's big, loud, and stupid. How we portray most men and things.
Actually, that is, I have one of the points that I have is that spectacle is very important in this movie. And a lot of the spectacle is explicitly about sort of displays of overt masculinity. Giant cars that are decorated in ridiculous ways. Those cars are very clearly very important to the people who are driving them. You have guitarists playing literal axes, double-necked axes on the top of giant rigs while flame is firing from both the car and the guitars. It is very much a movie that, again, it has taken the subtlety is not for cowards and gone, yes, but what if we infused it with nitrous and drove it to the moon?
Yeah, what if we took an allegory and like strapped it to a rocket ship and blasted it into space?
Yes.
Have you seen the sun? We'll get there. The couple things to really walk away from this, which we just started, so we're not going to walk away from it, obviously, but the couple of characters that we are introduced to from a masculine standpoint are Mad Max, Imperator Joe, and our war boy, who eventually is Mad Max's his blood donor, his blood bag, if you will. I believe his name is like,
it's Nuck, I believe.
Yeah, it's like Nuck. Yeah, I thought it was just Uck, but maybe it's Nuck. Some of these people do have an Australian accent, as they should.
Absolutely.
But yeah, those are our primary. Max and Nuck are like the two that like are our primary growth opportunities for characters.
Yeah, and Morton Joe is really there as, and I very much appreciate, I think with Creed, you got some like gesturing to what the current state of masculinity is, or some commentary on like how a masculinity operates in society. Here, I appreciate, again, subtlety. What even is that? You get Immortan Joe as, hey, we are going to just make the character that embodies the most toxic traits that one could label as masculine or patriarchal, and we're going to just put him on display and make it incredibly explicit.
Yeah, he's well known for things like women are possessions. He only wants male heirs. He's also hyper obsessed with image, and coming off as hyper ripped. He like the thing that he wears, which is like this weird strap-on clear suit that gives him like fake abs, is with fake metals, and like again the chipboard that's on there, which is like a stick of RAM that's like, hey, this is a metal too, is so good. For like, and he, you know, he gets spray painted with like white skin, and then that gets strapped onto him. We don't even need metaphors.
Yeah.
We're dealing in the literal here.
Yeah, it is very explicit and very... And hierarchy for him is incredibly important. He is at the top. He has very clearly indicated where everybody else lives in that hierarchy. And he very clearly gets to say whether or not you have moved ranks.
Yeah, he's literally the person who gets to turn the water on and off.
Yes.
Right? So we go from him back to the War Boys.
Yes.
And what their primary motivators are as characters, which is they want to die glorious deaths. Again, we saw this in the Northmen. Hey, turns out Vikings are now this weird part of pop culture, for better or for worse. If you understand political movements, you would understand why that is, for better and for worse.
Maybe a little bit disconcerting for some of us.
Yep. They want to, die in battle because they're already dying, right?
Well, and glory. It is very clear that they want glory. And again, explicitly, they are fodder for the machine. It is, I appreciate the way in which Miller wants to point out women are degraded and treated as property. Men are also fed to the machine. They also lose. They are also dying because of the way this system works. And he makes it incredibly explicit.
Yeah, the thing that I took away from how he deals with women, specifically in the film, and shows how Immortan Joe deals with women, we're introduced to three classes of women, multiple classes of people. You're either underneath, you either like the water gets turned on and off for you. Because you're not in the tower, or whatever that is. There are two classes of women. You're either overfed so that you can produce milk and offspring, or you're kept in a vault.
Yep.
You know? So, like... Oof. there's no good transition out of that, but like the class of women are very you're either unworthy to be any part of it, you're a good producer, or you're a prize.
Property. Yep. You are property. Yep. You are, yep, status.
Yep.
That is, again, Miller is very clearly, yep, making blatant commentary about, hey, patriarchy's kind of messed up, right?
But like, Immortan Joe is able to take kind of people who you would look at in a hyper-militaristic society that would be discarded, right? So you have the guy who's like the viewfinder, who is in an automated wheelchair for the entire film, very obviously handicapped, still being useful, right? Still doing... and what I mean by that is like specifically... using the skills that he has as being useful, where you do not see women in that role kind of at all throughout the entire film.
Absolutely.
Only for men, right? Like, yes. only men are able to exist that way as a Morton Joe's children, right? They're both of his children that you see are stunted in some way, shape, or form. His large, very large adult man son has an oxygen tank yes. the entire time. And that is used against him whenever he eventually fights Mad Max. But men are allowed to have specific flaws that we do not see any women possess outside of Furiosa, who doesn't have her arm.
Well, and I think it's important to note, though, that all of those men who have those specific flaws still have uses. Like, you still have to be productive. Like, there is still an expectation that you will contribute, that you will die for the cause, that you will submit your body to whatever it is that a Morton Joe needs from you. But you're right, that you have more options. The options are still bad, but you have more of them.
I would assume for a man like a Morton Joe, he's been doing a lot of producing, and we only see his sons, and he only cares about sons. So my assumption is imperfect daughters are not as useful, right? So
yes, I think that is a safe assumption.
That's the polite way to me say a whole bunch of things that I was going to say. But, you know, he's generally a piece of shit. So his sons are important to him. They get to flourish in positions otherwise that you wouldn't see kind of anyone really fill out of these specific types of characters. And, you know, then we do Mad Max Fury Road, which is Furiosa takes all these wives. She gets in a big truck and she goes, "We're gonna get the fuck out of here." She eventually encounters Mad Max being strapped to the front of a car. Mad Max holds her up at gunpoint with a fake gun. They fight. They drink a lot of water. And then they turn around and go home. Right? Like, the film as a mechanism of getting from point A to point B, very concise. As far as an emotional character journey, our named character, Mad Max, isn't really mad, other than he's slightly, again, unresolved trauma that he's dealing with that's very recent.
Yes.
That's it.
Which I think gets back to the point that you alluded to earlier when we first started talking about the movie. You have a situation here where Mad Max is our point of view character, but Mad Max is not our main character. And I think one of the ways that this interacts with the idea of masculinity and that the ways in which Miller is interested in discussing masculinity is that he does not want this to be a movie where our hero is the angry, mad, masculine man who's shooting everybody and beating everybody up. He wants that person to witness Furiosa and to support Furiosa in the journey that she is taking. And so you have a very fascinating scenario where our lead man is there primarily to see the woman who is actually taking the actions and to support those actions. So what does that mean about Miller's conception of masculinity, especially when you look at what he has shown you with the Morton Joe? How different is that conception of masculinity?
There is a version of this movie that Mad Max is your regular action movie star, right? He solves all the problems. He drives the truck the whole time. He is the best shot. Nothing, you know, he gets more of your Die Hard than what happens to him in this movie, where he's the primary problem solver. He's not the primary problem solver in this film. Like, he's not. He solves exactly like two problems.
Yeah,
he really,
I was gonna say
it's like
two.
He kind of
solves
one
and a half.
He goes, gets a bunch of guns, which happens off screen.
Yes.
He's like, "Hey, I'll be right back," and then he comes back covered in someone else's blood, and you don't even see that happen because him being good at what he does isn't really important to the story.
Correct.
And then his other primary motivation outside of like being a good combatant and being a reasonable fighter is he goes and convinces everyone to turn around. That's
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, and that's not because everyone else is dumber than him either. It's because he happens to have what is necessary for survival, which is less hope than everyone else, right?
Yes.
Like, he's very more pragmatic from a survival standpoint. And that really has more to do with his unreliance on others or his anti-reliance on others. He's very self-reliant, I guess, is to use the same word multiple times at the same sentence. He does not trust anyone. And so his thing about you can drive in the desert for 160 days and all you'll find is more sand, I'm assuming, because they're in Australia and the ocean has burned up.
It's a lot of sand out there.
Yeah. But instead, you know exactly where water is and it's behind you. So why run away from this thing when what you need to do is turn around and face it? And that's a lesson that we've learned through multiple films, right? You know, Garwin has to do the same thing, right? Turn around and face what he's dealing with. Except it's not Max that's going through that journey. It's Furiosa.
Like, yes.
She's the one who has to learn to, one, deal with her past, and two, deal with what she wants out of a future, which isn't out in the desert. It's leading groups of people to a new hope. That's Max's primary thing, and even Max knows that. At the end of the film, whenever they're like, hey, we did the good thing. We brought seeds that we can grow, even though there's plants in there. They already have stuff, mm-hmm. right? Like,
yes, they absolutely do.
That's a society that can actually exist, except what they did was they added classism to it. But now they can grow more stuff. Cool. Great. A lot of people had to die to get this, right? But really it's about, or what I took away from that was there is this internal journey that these two characters had to take together, Furiosa and Max. Max doesn't, there's the meme that Max doesn't really matter to that entire film, right? Like, that entire movie could happen without him, but it can't. He has to be there to steer that conversation back around.
Again, so the lens through which to see Furiosa. And there is a way in which Max's perspective is interesting to that. And I think that is the argument for why, well, you know, Max is, sure, he can be here. But I also think that you could argue that Furiosa does need to be able to lean on somebody. And I think it is interesting that you have these two characters that both have some trust issues, who both end up trusting each other very much. I mean, you even see the seeds of it at the very beginning where, and this is one thing that I really appreciate that I think, again, gets back to the idea of, this is part of the reason that I was like, he actually seems like he's like not maybe healthier than some of the other characters that we've run into. Because from the very beginning, instead of like getting in his own way, he is willing to cede some ground to Furiosa so that she can do stuff that needs to happen while they're getting chased. Despite the fact that if he really was going to dig into not trusting, if he was going to pull a Northman here and be like, no, I have this idea about the world and I refuse to let it go because I'm a stubborn man and I can't grow, he wouldn't have allowed that to happen. He would not have given her that bit of trust even that early on because he doesn't know her at all. But he also knows we don't get out of here alive if she doesn't do this thing. So either I go ahead and trust her a little bit and let her do the thing, or we all die.
I think in The Northman, Eggers does this thing where eventually Skarsgård and Anna Taylor-Joy are talking outside of a village or outside of one of the buildings. And Olga, the witch, is trying to explain what the plan is. And Skarsgård kind of goes, shut up, I have an idea. Let's move on, right? Like, the plot is revenge. Nothing else matters. I'll see you later. Imagine someone trying to interrupt Furiosa during this film. Like, it's impossible, especially not the character that Max is during this movie, to be like, hey, no, shut up. The plan is actually this. As you were specifically talking to, like, conceding, not only conceding like the mechanization to be successful. There's the scene where they're shooting the rifle and they only have 4 bullets left.
Yes.
And
I very much wanted to bring this up, so I'm glad you're going there.
And Zoe Kravitz is the one who remembers the ammo count. She is the very capable, knows how to fire a gun of the brides that they have stolen from Imperator Joe. And Max grabs the rifle and he's shooting it. And every time he fires the shot, she just goes, 3, 2, and then, Furioso comes over, grabs the rifle. Max hands it over, you know, like no questions asked,
well,
nothing.
It's great though, because Zoe goes 1, and then he pauses.
Yep.
Like he takes the rifle down, and it looks like he's recentering himself. And in the background, you can see Furiosa start to move forward. Like, I should do this now.
Yeah. And then uses his shoulder to rest the shot, you know, and tells him, you know, don't fuck it up, don't breathe, right? And then makes the shot that he cannot make in 3 other ones. Very much like a capability discrepancy between our two antagonists, because what Max brings from a masculine standpoint is not capability, right? He's not this savior character. He's not here to save the damsel in distress. He's not here to, these are not princesses that he's going to walk. He might have that idea, or you might have that idea. And specifically, our war boy who's with them for part of it kind of has a little bit of that idea, right? Not kind of comes away thinking, I'm going to give Immortan Joe his wives back and, I'm going to take them from Furiosa and, they're in distress and what they need is me to come save them. And then eventually he goes, oh no, but actually, Joe just needs them. And then we learn his growth because he's not capable, because he jumps on to the war rig and stumbles and gets, stuck in the railing. And Joe watches his stumble and goes, you fucking moron, and kind of moves on. Where we see men be vulnerable is opportunities for growth. It's one of the two, it's the trust point between Max and Furiosa. And it is where Nuck learns that the life that he's currently living is not worthwhile, right? He saw me fuck up is the primary thing that drives him to become closer to the women who are escaping, right? And they bring him into the fold. They know that he's just as vulnerable as they are, that he's just as not abused in the same way, but just as exploited as a person, because they exploited his masculinity. The point that drives him forward is his need to be useful, because he's not useful for anything else other than fighting and dying. That's it. That's all he brings to the table. And whenever he fails at that, that's whenever he becomes vulnerable, and that's whenever they can latch onto him as a character and really bring him into the fold and make him into a three-dimensional person instead of the person that he starts that film as.
Well, and a lot of that does have to do with everybody in that scenario recognizing him as a full person and not turning him into a masculine stereotype. And I think that gets back to some of the stuff that we talked about with Creed, where the movie gives this character the space to be a man who messes up, who does not understand how things are supposed to be, who can be vulnerable about it, who other characters can recognize have also been damaged by the system, can point that out, and can offer an alternative that he then can say, oh, you see me, you see what I'm going through, I can sit with this vulnerability and I can lean into it. I can become part of this family, which is not always the thing that men will do in the sort of stereotypically masculine thing is stay stoic, stay Northman, keep doing the revenge thing, continue to uphold that Norse value of be witnessed dying for the great purpose.
He still does that. So like he still
Oh, sure, sure. But, like
he doesn't look, learn everything, no, but
like he dies because of love though.
But his purpose changes.
Yes.
Right? And that's the growth, right? Like he realizes the great purpose is not to bring these prizes back. The purpose is
when
to
When he isn't, it's very important that they don't ask him to make that sacrifice. At no point does anybody say to Nuck, "We need you to blow this truck up so that we can escape." They explicitly tell him, "You make sure you come back safe." So they place value on his presence in a way that Immortan Joe and the rest of the War Boys never did. And so he gets to make the active choice to say, "No, no, no, I care about these people and they care about me. And in order to protect them, I am going to sacrifice myself."
One of the things that we consistently see throughout the entire film is the idea that masculinity is a thing to be exploited. We see that with the War Boys, everyone's favorite meme on planet Earth from the film is that's bait, which is whenever Mad Max sees a naked woman in a light post or in an antenna and she's naked and says, "Please help me, please help me." And he knows well enough that that's him, that's someone exploiting men, right? The type of people who would wander the wasteland to figure out exactly, you know, like, "Oh, of course, oh, a naked woman tied in a thing. I better save her. Maybe I'll get something out of this." Run by the many mothers, right? Like, yes. That's their gimmick. "Hey, if you're this stupid to fall for this, I've shot every man that I've ever met in the back of the head," right?
Yes. Like,
but I think there's something there to the idea that the toxic side of masculinity is toxic.
Yes.
That's the one thing that this film does that I think The Northman doesn't do.
Yes.
Is that we see that ramp built to show us what is and isn't healthy. And not only is toxic masculinity not healthy, but it's a thing to be exploited. It's a thing to keep you oppressed, you know, to keep classist systems in place, to really lock you into your state of life is by adhering to societal and cultural norms of what it is to be a man.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that is part of the difficulty that I had with that movie is that it's hard for me to tell if that movie wanted to have that conversation. And the thing that I appreciate with Mad Max Fury Road is that Miller makes it very explicit. So it's impossible to miss that that's the conversation that he does want to have. And it's impossible not to see the ways in which he's engaging with it. And I think engaging with it incredibly effectively.
Yeah, especially because Furiosa's entire thing is like being an Imperator is because she's overlooked, right?
Yes.
She's specifically, has a disability where she's missing it. You know, she's missing an arm either through combat or through other means. She's consistently looked down upon because women are seen as property, and that allows her to be the one who allows for escape. And that's everything we have to say about Mad Max Fury Road, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
And that will do it for January 2023's episode of Cultural Fugazi, where we talked about masculinity. If you want to reach us through email means, there's other ways to get a hold of us, especially if you know us, but if you want to send us an email for the podcast, you can send one to us@fugazipod.com, us@fugazipod.com. That's the email that you can reach Chris and I at, and we can happily talk about some of our thoughts, or I'm sure you can find us at a bar and buy us a beer if you know where we are.
Absolutely. I mean, certainly would be interested to get other opinions about these movies and how other folks who have listened and watched, how they think that those messages play out or don't.
The other thing to take away from this is that these are not the only four movies that talk about this. There are some other specific movies or things that we were thinking about or almost watched and didn't include. A couple movies that immediately come to mind or even longer forms. So TV shows, The Sopranos, Breaking Bad. There's tons of stuff that really have to deal with kind of masculinity and those regards. A couple other movies with some softer boys in them. Chris, you were just watching one.
Absolutely. And I think there would have been some interesting things that Scott Pilgrim versus the World had to say about the conversations that we've had. So certainly, if you do want to see just not a man who looks like he would punch a bunch of people end up punching a bunch of people, which is part of what makes it interesting, Scott Pilgrim versus the World. And I think we definitely saw a lot of discussion about the very hard stereotype of masculinity. And I think Scott Pilgrim does a nice job of tackling the nice guy and how that actually has a lot of masculine baggage to it as well.
To bring it back to The Sopranos, that is a situation where someone actually does go to therapy.
Sure. Yeah.
There's a man who actually goes to therapy in that. That will do it for this month's episode. Thank you for listening. Like and subscribe. Leave us a podcast review on your podcatcher of choice. And we will be back in about a month or 2 weeks, depending on how we edit this, for another episode of Culture Fugazi.
It's been great.
Take care.
Whole equation.
I saw the Green Knight. You can kiss me if you need to kiss me.
I appreciate that, Justin.
We might not be healthy people for it, but if you need to kiss me.
Oh my goodness.